Coming up on Weekend America.
Just because your candidate quit does not mean you get to take the weekend off.
All these display lights are now decorated with Kucinich for President blue balloons. Yeah, it's just to make it a little happier place.
That's nice. Well, the voting continues this weekend, and the diehards soldier on. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. This weekend is your chance to create something this good.
This was the greatest letter anyone had ever written to me. It was like a declaration of love. It was a serenade outside my window.
We'll help you turn love into words. And let's say you're at a concert and you've recently been robbed.
My friend's wife zeroed in on a fellow, and she had taken up an empty seat behind the fellow. Pretty soon, she got up, she worked her way back through the crowd, and she said, "Ted, that guy's got your shirt on."
What happens next? Your best concert stories are coming up on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. When you write a love letter, it's because you're in love, right? Later this hour, an author will tell us about love letters written in unloving moments. He says they still qualify. What would you write in a love letter to a person you barely even knew?
I guess it should say what your heart's feeling.
Start off by, hello, my name is, and I have a crush on you.
You know, you talk from your heart. You can't express things that you do not feel. And if you feel something good for somebody, express it and tell them like it is.
But what's writing letters to people that you barely know, especially love letters?
I would probably say that I have a crush on you. You're really nice and a gentle person. And I would like to hang out with you sometime. You shouldn't say, "I would want to marry you right now."
Maybe not if you're nine, you shouldn't. No.
I think that's good advice generally. Those voices
True.
Came from New York, San Francisco, and Las Vegas.
Well, this weekend, the presidential campaign continues without Mitt Romney. People are voting in Kansas, Louisiana, Nebraska, the Virgin Islands, and Washington State. Of course, just because a candidate has left the campaign does not mean his supporters have quit. Ohio's Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich dropped out recently to focus on his congressional reelection. And as Weekend America's John Moe tells us, the Kucinich campaign rolls on. John has been bringing us a series called I'm Also Running for President, focusing on the non-frontrunners. This weekend, John drops in on the Washington State headquarters of Kucinich for President.
I'm in Shoreline, Washington, just north of Seattle. There's a Korean barbecue place, payday loans, taco stand operating out of a school bus. Okay, here we go. 15005 Aurora Avenue North. The sign on top says it's a jewelry store, but oh, yep, Kucinich signs in the windows. I'm going to meet some people who are either living in a quixotic, delusional dream world or are nobly crusading on behalf of their ideals. I'll let you decide which.
Hello, I'm Rebecca Wolf. I'm the Washington State Coordinator for the Dennis Kucinich Campaign 2008. We are in the state headquarters office of the Kucinich campaign.
But it also says diamonds and fine gemstones on the window.
That's because all of our supporters are fine gemstones. They are all gems, and they are diamonds as well.
That's not why it says that.
Oh, well, it formerly was a jewelry store, and until a renter chooses to rent here, I guess we can stay here and work on our issues even after the campaign is over.
Rebecca, many would argue the campaign is over. Your candidate dropped out. Why are you still here?
The message is not-for-profit single-payer health care needs a voice in our government and in our House of Representatives. Ending illegitimate wars and building peace needs a voice. Bilateral trade agreements needs a voice. And so he is the voice, but we are also the voice. We are still here because we feel that at the precinct level, you can vote. You can actually caucus for anyone. I mean, you could even caucus for Al Gore or somebody who's not even on the ballot. But Dennis Kucinich is still on the ballot.
So what's the strategy going into Saturday for your organization?
Okay. Our strategy is that we'd like to have everybody there no later than 1 o'clock and sign in. And the first preference would be Kucinich. If we don't have enough for a delegate, then we will go uncommitted. And what we want is more and more people to go uncommitted so that neither Obama nor Clinton can get a win. And if we could get enough uncommitted people, then they could influence the policies or the platform or even the voting at the national convention.
Tell me a little bit about what's been going on in this storefront. We're at a long table here. There's a bunch of chairs set up.
We have meetings here, and people come here to get information. But mainly it's for our meetings, our weekly meetings, our team meetings.
And the balloons are to make it more festive?
Yes. The balloons are this was a jewelry store, and all these display lights are now decorated with Kucinich for President blue balloons. Yeah, it's just to make it a little happier place. Yeah. And we have banners that say Denis Kucinich, the life of the party, because after he was bumped from, I think, the Nevada debate by the Supreme Court, we had a conference call for all the state coordinators, and I remember the New York coordinator said, "Denis, what do I tell people now that you've dropped out?" He said, "Just tell them I'm the life of the party."
After he dropped out, did you think for a while, geez, do we keep this going?
At first I thought, oh, now I can rest a little bit. You know, I mean, for my own selfish purposes, momentarily I thought, well, I can get my life back now, back to normal, you know, see my grandchildren and my children again. And then right away we were getting messages from people who, and I agree with them, we have to stay on message, and we have to keep this going.
Is the strategy the same as if he had stayed in?
Yes, it would be the same. Mm-hmm.
Before I left, I was handed a business card by the only other person there, Mary Ritalik. She had gotten the card printed up herself. It said office manager. Mary does all the work on the one computer they have set up. She rides the bus 2 hours every morning from Tacoma, and then 2 hours back home at the end of the day. It's a volunteer position. I walked out the door as Rebecca and Mary got back to work, getting ready for the caucus. In Shoreline, Washington, with the Kucinich campaign, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
And here's a fun fact. In 2004, Howard Dean won the Vermont primary 12 days after dropping out of the presidential race.
Well, we've analyzed the presidential races from a lot of angles, but not from the vantage point of another country, like Kenya. People there have a special connection to Barack Obama, whose father was Kenyan. But some of their support for Obama may be changing, for tribal reasons. In December, Kenyans went to the polls as a unified nation. But after claims of rigged results, the nation has fractured along old class and tribal lines. More than 1,000 people have died in the violence since then. Dana Hughes reports from Nairobi for ABC News. She's been there for the last 4 months. And I asked her how Kenyans talked about Obama last year before the upheaval.
Everyone that I spoke to about Barack Obama was really excited about the prospect of him being president. Barack Obama's father is Kenyan. He's actually from the Luo tribe. They view him as being one of them.
So how has the view of Barack Obama changed since the elections in Kenya in December?
The events that have occurred have really shown that there is quite a tribalistic undertone to Kenya. When I say tribalistic, it's also tied to class. It's not simply tribe. But I found that has spilled over to what some people say they feel about Barack Obama. Barack Obama's father was a prominent Luo, and Raila Odinga, who's the opposition leader, is also a Luo. When you start talking to an older generation, particularly those of the Kikuyu tribe, which is President Mwai Kibaki's tribe, I've actually found people that have said they want Hillary Clinton to be the president. And you ask them, why do they support Hillary Clinton? You get cheapest answers. You get answers like, well, I just don't think a black man could ever be president, or not a black man like that.
Take me back and give me a little bit of background about the tensions between the different tribal factions in Kenya.
Basically, what a lot of this comes down to is colonialism and the way that the British distributed land and who they favored and who they chose not to favor. And then right after colonialism, you had two presidents that in many ways just continued on with those policies.
Would you compare this to a Rwanda?
No. In Rwanda, you really had two tribes. You had the Tutsis and the Hutus. But in Kenya, there are 42 tribes. And there are four or five major tribes. And what's happened in Kenya is each president and then many of the president's people, the president's men that he surrounded him with, have manipulated tribal tensions for their own gain.
Describe for me, what are the differences between some of the major tribes in Kenya in terms of their culture, or what are they known for?
They each have their own music and their own dance. Maasais are very well known because they have the outfits, and I mean, when you see pictures of Kenya, it's usually the Maasai that you see. They each have their own languages, actually, and that has been one of the ways in which some of the ethnic violence, and particularly lately the reprisal attacks, have occurred, with Kikuyus asking people, do you speak with Kikuyu gangs? If you can't speak Kikuyu back, then they pull you out.
You are an African-American, but you're not of Kenyan descent. How do you feel walking about the country?
Now, I get mistaken for a Kikuyu all the time. Because for here, people consider me to be fairly light-skinned. So in covering this story, it's added an extra element of care that I've had to have with my reporting. When one of the times I was in Kibera, the audio technician that was with us started laughing as we were leaving, and I said, what's so funny? And he said, oh, all those guys, they were saying, she's just an ordinary Kikuyu girl with a fake accent. She's trying to sound American. And I thought it was funny, but then my next thought was, so perhaps I shouldn't be relying on my accents for security.
Well, Dana, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
That was ABC News reporter Dana Hughes talking to us from Kenya.
Des, do you know how is this strife in Kenya translating to Kenyan communities here and the way they look at Barack Obama?
Yeah, I talked to Karen Ochola. She's a Kenyan-American in Durham, North Carolina. And she said that really the tribalism has not crossed the waters here. They see themselves as Kenyan. They're proud that someone of Kenyan ancestry is running for president. So they're supporting Obama. They think that it's interesting that the elections in Kenya were all about a change. And now here on this waters, they're also talking about change as the theme.
Mm-hmm.
And they're raising money for relief efforts. They're not really focusing on raising money now for Obama. You're listening to Weekend America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Riding the range with a century-old rancher, coming up on Weekend America.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and this is Weekend America, the radio show about what's happening in the U.S. this weekend. As you know, tornadoes have swept through the American South, taking lives and causing hundreds of millions of dollars in damage. President Bush has declared disaster areas in parts of Tennessee and Arkansas. That'll free up federal aid. But cleanup efforts are already underway this weekend on the local level. In Sumner County, Tennessee, for example, hundreds of volunteers are gathering today, people organizing in parking lots and churches, offering help to those hardest hit. Chris Howell is leading the effort at Hartsville Pike Church of Christ in Gallatin, which is just down the road from where a tornado took seven lives. The church has become a makeshift storm shelter. Chris, welcome to Weekend America.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
What are you doing in Hartsville today, Chris?
Well, right now we've got a bunch of crews that are getting ready. Hang on a minute.
Do anyone else in the intro yet?
No. We've got a bunch of crews that we're sending out into the tornado area that came through the other night. We just loaded up some trailers to go to various churches, and now everybody's kind of congregated around so we can get them going with the cleanup effort.
And what are the main jobs that need to be done?
We've got crews that came in with heavy equipment, bobcats, front-end loaders, and we've got youth groups from other churches here that can do heavy hauling, and we've got volunteers here at the church that have fixed sack lunches and things to go out with the volunteer groups and also to hand out to the people that are still out in the area that aren't willing to come into the church to, you know, ask for anything. So,
Chris, will you give us a sense of what you've seen this week?
One thing that stands out in my mind, there was a gas pipeline up in the Hartsville area that exploded the night that the tornado came through. Just yesterday, I met and talked with a gentleman whose house was directly backed up to the pipeline. When it exploded, it blew up his house. He and his family, they got underneath the house in the crawl space. They all survived, but they lost everything. His wife and himself, they both suffered injuries. His wife has suffered a broken neck and a broken vertebra in her spine, and she has been in critical care until yesterday. Her husband came in. He was still kind of shell-shocked and was asking if it would be possible that we could get a crew out there to help clean up the area out there because no one had been out there.
Chris, what do you say to this man?
Well, you know, the only thing you can say is, you know, hey, we're here. What do you need? A lot of people in this area, they're a proud people, and they won't ask for anything. They like to do for themselves. And they're so shocked by everything that's going on, they're not going to ask for anything. They're just going to, you know, kind of be working on their own. But then when they get some help, you know, seeing that somebody's willing to help and to relieve them of that burden is what this is all about.
I can't imagine what this experience does to you, Chris. How are you feeling today? How are you handling all this?
Well, I've been able to get sleep, actually, and I try not to let it affect me directly because now if my place was one of them that had been devastated, I would probably want to be there. But knowing that I've got to fill a need here at the church and help everybody else out, that this is where I'd be.
Chris, I know you have work to do. Thank you so much for spending this time with us, and good luck.
Sure, no problem. It was great talking to you.
Chris Howell lives in Gallatin, Tennessee. We talked to him at the Hartsville Pike Church of Christ.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, you're listening to Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. The Grammys are this weekend, and what I love the most are the live performances between the awards. I am still trying to recover from the 2004 Open when Prince and Beyonce started the show. Mm. Oh, my God, it was awesome.
You think that's something, Des? I watched Kanye West take flight a few years ago. Human flight.
Well, we've asked you all to share your most memorable concert experiences with us. And Ina Carroll contacted us with her story. She's from Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. And a lasting memory, for better or worse, was the time when she was invited to a Hall & Oates concert in the late 70s by a hunk, a very attractive guy. Well, I'll let Ina describe him.
You know what he looked like? He looked like Ashton Kutcher, but better looking. Honest to God, that's how good looking he was. And I know I took extra care getting dressed, and I was so excited I could wear heels because he was so tall and I had cute jeans. And I anxiously awaited him to come pick me up. And he drove up in a pretty big car, and he walked down the path to the front door, and I was all excited, ready to go. And as we were walking back to the car, I could see two heads in the back seat, and I thought, oh, we must be double dating. I wonder why he didn't tell me. And I get in, and I see it's two girls. And I'm just stunned, sitting in the front seat, thinking, who are these girls, and why are they here on my date? She'll only come out at night, lean and hungry tight. So we get to the concert, and he goes off and takes pictures of Hall & Oates down by the stage. He's gone. We're sitting in our seats and just kind of looking at each other because the music was so loud there wasn't much we could talk about. But I never, ever talked to him again. I was just mortified that he had asked me on a date and brought two girls along with him and never explained, to me at least, what was going on. You know, I don't like Hall & Oates anymore. I used to love their songs, and now when I hear, do they sing Sarah Smile? I think they do. Yes. That I used to love that song. I just used to love that song. I remember writing out all the lyrics. Now when I hear it on the radio, I could care less. So he ruined it for me, Hall & Oates.
Eyes. I can feel you watching in the night. All alone with me.
I'm swaying with my lighter. Can you see me now?
Yeah. Don't let it ruin that
I know.
Song.
That was listener Ina Carroll from Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. And we're going to have more of your best and worst concert going stories coming up.
You warm me. And when I feel I can't go on, you come and hold me. It's you and me forever. Sarah.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MBA Program.
Coming up, you can text it, you can calligraphy it, you can scrawl it on a barf bag. It's been done. Just say, I love you on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper in the Twin Cities. This weekend, it's the 2008 Cattle Industry Annual Convention in Reno, Nevada. Ranchers from across the country are there, but one is missing, Attilio Genasi. He worked a 1,400-acre ranch for most of his 98 years.
Farming is a way of life. You have to love it. You don't farm and say, well, when I'm 65, I'll sell and retire and go to the city. That thought never entered my mind. I'm still working at 97. Like I told my family, I hope I die with my boots on out there working on the ranch.
Genasi was born in 1909 in California's Sierra Valley, a pristine alpine valley about 30 miles northwest of Reno. The rancher and environmentalist lived there his whole life, and he died there on January 29th. Over the years, Genasi watched his valley change, and he led an effort to preserve the open space in the West. Just before he died, he showed independent producer Jessica Maria Ross around the family ranch.
Well, there's fewer year-round families that stay here with their cattle and everything. What is there, one or two of us? Well, there used to be about 85. Yeah, here's the cows that we worked yesterday.
You guys stay inside.
I have traveled a lot, and I've seen the other world. And when I come back here, I see what I have. It's a beautiful, beautiful valley. Some people say it's the largest alpine valley at 5,000 feet elevation in North America. I get up sometime at when the snow's on the ground, you see a blanket of snow. You can hear the train on the other end of the valley, 18 miles, you hear the clickety-clack of the trains that go by. It's so quiet and peaceful here. When my wife and I were first married, a realtor stopped by and said, asked Angie if she'd sell him some land up next to the mountain there. He had a person who wanted to build houses up there. And she told him in no uncertain terms that her land was not for sale then or ever would be for sale to build houses on. And before she died, she said, I want my ashes scattered on the ranch here on the fields north of the house. And I'm not going to let somebody build a house there with a cesspool where I scattered her ashes. And I'll never betray the trust that she placed in me. The land does not belong to me. The land belongs to future generations. And the land also belongs to the general public. It's one of the natural wonders that's there for humanity. And we dare not destroy it any more than we'd cap the geysers in Yellowstone or put the Bridal Veil Falls of Yosemite in a pipe. I think we have a natural wonder here that I'll do my best to preserve.
Attilio Genasi died January 29th on the ranch where he had lived and worked his entire life. That story was produced by Jessica Maria Ross and is part of the public radio series Stories from the Heart of the Land, produced by Jay Allison and Emily Botine. There's a link to the series on our website, weekendamerica.org. You're listening now to a song from Catherine Feeney called I Come Home.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. And even if your cerebrum knows that Valentine's Day is a commercially driven greeting card holiday, you still might be occupied this weekend with how to express your love. Well, you don't have to be treacly. There is an anthology out called Other People's Love Letters. The editor, Bill Shapiro, collected letters from friends, strangers, anybody who would share, and he purposely included love's low points. Bill, welcome to Weekend America.
Thanks so much for having me.
Some of these letters are outright painful. One example is just someone who wrote the word liar, what was it, 183 times? Why did you include that stain of pain?
Because we all feel that. I would say that this is a really fair and accurate representation of love. Most of the time that you see a collection of love letters, it's all really rosy and everything's up and glorious. And that's actually not what happens to people who are in a long relationship. And I think anybody who's been in a long relationship knows that there are difficult parts, and you can still love somebody through the difficult parts. And then there are the really difficult parts where you reconsider your love, and maybe you write a letter during those moments. And to me, they're still love letters. They're just not what we usually think of when we think of love letters.
Are you talking from experience? Did you come to this with that in mind?
Oh, you're good. Yes, I do come to it from experience. I was divorced not that long ago. And yeah, there's a lot of emotions that go hand in hand with that, and it makes you re-examine the love letters that you had written and that you had received, and the sort of both the lasting nature of the letter itself, that piece of paper, and the ephemeral nature of the sentiments, you know, written on the letter.
What's a theme that jumped out and surprised you from these letters?
You know, there's letters going back to 1911, and there's, you know, text messages written at the end of 2006. And I think what really comes through is that people so badly want to be understood.
I could argue that one of the dominant emotions in this book is insecurity.
Well, yeah, that's definitely there. I think it's a scary thing being in love because, you know, it could be over. You know, there's also some letters here that I think are full of confidence. You know, there's one that comes to mind, which is a woman who's relationship ended in a divorce after some years. And it's a long letter, but one of the things she writes to her ex, you know, a year after, to me feels full of confidence. She says, "One more thing you did for me, you left, and I had to get through it. I have learned this year that my ability to handle what happens to me greatly exceeds my expectations. I thought I would die if you left me. I had this idea that I would crumble, that I'd have to go live with my mom and curl up in a bed for months. This is so untrue, and I have some amends to make to myself for thinking so little of my strength."
Does this letter lose anything for you because it's an email?
Oh, God, no. Not at all. The timing is so perfect because you get it the moment that somebody is thinking about you instead of 3 days or more for it to get to you.
So let's say someone is this weekend thinking, oh, my God, I've got to compose something, and it's got to work. But the timing is official. The timing is practically government-mandated February 14th. What advice do you give to someone composing this weekend?
Well, I guess I would start now. And you've got a tool for everything in your toolkit. And sometimes the long handwritten letters is the one, and sometimes it's just, "I want you now," text message. The best ones are really honest. And it's the same thing that makes a good lover is what makes a good love letter. You know, knowing when to be strong, knowing when to be vulnerable, and definitely getting the person's name right.
Yeah, that is key. Bill Shapiro, thanks a lot for the letters and for this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me, and have a great weekend.
Bill Shapiro there telling us there are no rules in letters of love, except he does have one taboo, he told me. No emoticons. That's his rule. The book is Other People's Love Letters, and you could read some of them at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Well, maybe Rob McGinley Myers could have benefited from Other People's Love Letters when he was studying in Spain 11 years ago. Now, there he was in the land of Don Juan, but he wasn't very suave when it came to love. All that was about to change one Valentine's Day when he put his heart on paper.
I'd known Nancy for 3 weeks when she came to my 21st birthday party in a hotel room in Madrid.
She was cute and funny and one of the few American girls in Spain who didn't wear makeup. We stayed up talking long after our friends had all left or gone to sleep. I was staring at the wall, trying to get up the nerve to make a move, when I noticed that Nancy had fallen asleep too. I turned off the light, assuming I'd missed my chance, but the sound of the clicking lamp woke her up, and it was there, in the complete darkness, that we finally kissed. It seemed like a magical beginning, but Nancy regretted the whole thing.
You were so uncertain about everything and so willing to do whatever other people wanted. It was like I just didn't feel like I knew you at all. You seemed really nice, but I didn't have any idea that you actually had a personality. You know? Wherever you guys want to go, what are you drinking? What should I order? Where should we go? I'll go too. There's not much excitement in that.
Nancy told me she didn't want to get involved, and I didn't put up much of a fight. I'd never believed I could actually change a girl's mind if she wasn't interested in me. But something about that night in the dark with Nancy was hard to let go of. All this happened right before Valentine's Day, so I used that as an excuse to write Nancy a letter.
Dear Nancy, well, this is the third letter I've started to you since we left Madrid. I'm back in Granada today, and you probably are
I spent
too.
The first few pages of this supposed love letter going on and on about myself, my history, and my idea that you can never really know the truth about anything. I guess I was confused. I didn't think I was in love. But when I finally got around to addressing Nancy in the letter, I found myself creating a future for us that I hadn't consciously considered until I was writing about it.
So the thing is, Nancy, the thing that I really want is to kiss you again. I understand all of your hesitations, but I don't have any good reasons or arguments for you other than the fact that that night with you, in the dark, was one of the most comfortable, wonderful experiences, for lack of any good word, I've ever had with anyone. So all I can assure you of is that right now, at 7:03 p.m. on Sunday the 16th of February, I want this thing, whatever it is. Of course we'll still be friends if that isn't what you want. I just didn't want you to have to make this.
This was the greatest letter anyone had ever written to me.
It was like a declaration of love. It was a serenade outside my window.
But I think that if I just said to you, I really don't want to let you go, and I don't want to just be your friend. Mm-hmm. Don't you think we would have wound up exactly where we are without this letter?
I mean, I think you could have said those things to me, but the question is, would you have said those things to me? And if I would have been there with you, would I really have responded appropriately? Whereas I read that letter in my room alone, had the chance to think about how I wanted to respond to it. I think because it was a letter, and I think because it was that letter, that's why I dated you in Spain.
Nancy kissed me again about 12 hours after I gave her that letter. And we've been together now for 11 years, married for almost 8. But it's hard for me to believe that something I wrote when I was 21 could have set the course for the rest of my life. To me, love is irrational, and I don't believe you can persuade someone to love you with a mere letter. I think they just love you or they don't. Nancy says I'm missing the point.
They either love you or they don't. They have a crush on you or they don't. What you are persuading them to is to commit to it and to do something about it. Writing me that letter didn't make me want to kiss you. I already wanted to kiss you. It just made me kiss you.
Whew, can you feel the heat?
That's good.
That was awesome. That was Rob McGinley Myers. He's an associate producer at American Public Media's Speaking of Faith. You can see photos of Rob and Nancy when they were just kids in Spain. And you can see the letter on our website. Just go to weekendamerica.org.
This is the radio show about what's happening in America this weekend. And as Des said earlier, it's Grammy weekend. Tomorrow we will see live performances. We'll also find out who the best new artist is and what America's favorite song was and who got snubbed. But right now we're hearing your favorite live music memories, the concert experiences you can never forget. This one comes to us from listener Francis Perkins from Memphis, Missouri.
When I was around 9 or 10 years old and a huge Elvis fan,
He was just starting out, and back then, anyone could wander around backstage. My friend Jackie and I followed Elvis everywhere except the bathroom. But one night, Elvis put one empty soda cup on the counter instead of the trash can. Jackie and I both dived for the cup, and in seconds, the air was rent with screams as two formerly delicate southern flowers proceeded to try to kill each other. The paper cup was destroyed, and we were thereafter banned from backstage, possibly the first two females to battle over an Elvis souvenir.
Love me tender, love me long, take me to your heart.
That was listener Francis Perkins from Memphis, Missouri.
For it's then that I belong and will never part.
In Romeo, Michigan, the weather's going to dip into the teens this weekend. In Juliet, Georgia, it's going to be in the mid-60s, but it's always sunny when you're in love. For more pre-Valentine's weather, here's Weekend America's John Moe.
Snow 32 in Big Sky, Montana, and they're throwing dummies off a mountain. Not mannequins, they're literally hurling stupid people. Kidding, it's mannequins. Dummies at the dummy jump are judged on style, distance, and explosion upon landing. You know, just to be on the safe side, stupid people should probably just wait at the bottom of the mountain, but not near the exploding dummies. If you can't make it to Delray Beach, Florida, just point your nose in that direction. You'll know what's going on. The Delray Beach Garlic Festival presents fine wines, live entertainment, 80 degrees, and showers, which might mitigate the smell, but not much. The festival was rated the least popular tourist event in the world by readers of Vampire Vacation Monthly. The lake's frozen in Neosho, Wisconsin, but fun is just heating up. Besides snowmobile races, they offer bed racing, where teams push a bed custom-fitted with skis and handlebars around an obstacle course. Does that make it okay to sleep while you drive? Snow and 23 at the event, also featuring sausage racing, because all public gatherings in Wisconsin must include sausage. State law. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Wowie zowie, do we have some wild concert memories for you coming up on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by LendingTree, helping customers find the fixed-rate loan that's right for them. You can choose from up to four offers today, 1-800-555-TREE or at LendingTree.com. When banks compete, you win.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. Desiree Cooper's in the Twin Cities. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles, where the Grammys happen this weekend. And the best thing about the Grammys is that you have the nominees in the chamber music category and bluegrass and Hawaiian and children's music and polka, and you get a bunch of them in the same building, and they perform this amazing, eclectic concert.
Yeah, unless you're Amy Winehouse and you have to perform by satellite because you face drug possession charges that cause you visa problems.
True.
Anyway, to mark the 50th year of the Grammys, we're presenting your best concert stories this hour. Now, live music seems to bring out the weird in us. You've told us how you fought over Elvis memorabilia. You've turned your back on Hall & Oates. You've been a victim of a mosh pit gone bad.
Before I knew it, I was pushed completely out of control by this overwhelming tidal wave of people just pushed me forward, and I was pushed up on top of the crowd. And instantly, my T-shirt was just ripped off of me, and I never saw it again.
Oh, I feel you. We all been there. Not. This was J.A. Dratz from Needles, California. He was describing a Ramones concert that he went to in Hollywood back in the mid-'80s. Our next concert memory takes place in Texas. It involves a group of young girls, a hitchhiker, and a bad sense of direction.
Hi, this is Bobby Larson of Duluth, Minnesota. My craziest concert memory takes me back to the 70s when I lived in Austin, Texas. One day, some friends and I had tickets to see Frank Zappa in San Antonio, so we drove down there.
Wowie, zowie, your love's a freaky. Wowie, zowie, you can't be beat. Wowie, zowie, baby, you're so neat.
I don't even care if you shave your legs.
San Antonio is already a very confusing city, and to be honest, we were stoned, so we got lost trying to find the auditorium. We saw a small, skinny guy with wild hair walking down the street, carrying a guitar case, and we stopped him and asked him if he knew where the auditorium was. Yeah, he said, I'm going there, give me a ride, and I'll show you. So he hopped in, and in just a few minutes, we were at the auditorium. Thanks, he said, got out. And it wasn't until he came out on stage that we realized we had given Frank Zappa a ride to his own concert.
Baby, I'll be true. I don't even care if your dad's the heat.
When I think back on this concert, it's just really such a great memory. I can clearly see him walking down the street in his jeans and T-shirt. And my family and friends are tired of this story because they have heard it over and over again.
Hi, I'm Warren Jacobs calling from Cardiff, California. In the over the last 40 years in San Diego, I have seen dozens and dozens of concerts, almost every major or minor act that's come to Southern California. But the one that sticks out of my mind the most is one that I went to in 1996, the U2 concert with my wife, Dana. At that time, U2 was boycotting Ticketmaster. So at the prescribed time and date, we phoned in at the very second and we ordered tickets, but we had no idea where the seats were going to be located. And to our total happiness, they were on the main floor right along the rail about halfway down the main floor. Probably about a third of the way through the concert, Bono and the band strolled down and they did a song, I don't even remember which one, right in front of us. No obstruction at all. And so we were just having the time of our lives and we're getting more and more excited. And then to my complete surprise, my wife just jumped up and over the railing she went. She just vaulted the railing.
Yeah, she's a promise.
And the security guard started, you know, racing down to cut her off, and Bono waved him off. And they just kind of formed a cordon so nobody else could come in. And so she began to dance, and the spotlight was on her and the band, and it was utterly fantastic. You know, we were just screaming. I was just screaming, and it was so funny. And she, the jumbo screen was up, and so we had friends who later were in the nosebleed seats said, you know, we saw Dana on the floor on the jumbo screen. I think my face hurt for days later because I was laughing and smiling so much. It was great to watch.
To see your wife on the Jumbotron is to truly live. We got so many concert stories from you. I liked one that came in from Ted Shelton of Butte La Rose, Louisiana. Ted was living in north central Arizona. And he comes down to Phoenix to warm up, gets his car stolen. The clothes he had in the car are gone, including a shirt that his friend's wife, Dawn, had made for him as a gift. So complete bummer at this point. But a few weeks later, Ted scores tickets to a Waylon Jennings concert, which he says is, quote, the absolute ultimate number one best thing in a mountain cowboy's life, end quote. Okay, so he and his friends are filing into the Coliseum, and Dawn grabs his sleeve, says, Ted, that guy has your shirt on. That's a shirt I made for you. And he does. And not only that, the guy's wearing a belt with the name Ted tooled into the leather of the belt. So we either have an amazing coincidence or a fist fight here. So violence is contemplated, but instead, cooler heads prevail. Security is called. Police show up. There's interviews and paperwork. And so Ted is dealing with all this, misses the Waylon Jennings concert completely. Just, you know, hears thuds in the distance. That's all. Never finds out whether the guy got arrested. Gets his shirt and belt sent to him in the mail by the cops 3 years later. Ted says he told his son the story, and the moral was leave the shirt and belt behind and just enjoy the concert.
There you go. You can read Ted's letter and all of our listeners' concert stories. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
We were telling concert stories because the Grammys are this weekend. If that's in your plans, enjoy that. And thanks for spending an hour with us. This is American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. You can go to our website, weekendamerica.org, and find some little-known black history facts or download a free podcast of our show. Hey, get out there and enjoy your weekend.
News and financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
On the next Weekend America, Obama girl, the dean screams, Swift boat attacks. Has campaigning always been this way?
There was a lot of faulty roll and her raw techniques and mass meetings and swilling the electorate with free hard cider.
Both sides thought the other side would destroy American democracy, the American dream.
Sound familiar? This weekend, everything old is new again on the next Weekend America.